This is Brian
Kreuzberger.
The Brian Kreuzberger Show.
It's not too difficult to remember.
Kreuzer. He's interviewing money people. Isn't that what it is?
Kreuzer Burger.
What do you think?
Kreuzberger. That's not a deal breaker.
I'm really excited to introduce you to today's guest. When I graduated from college in 2002 from University of Arizona, I really made it a point to do anything but go to class. But after I graduated, I realized I had to learn how to do sales and how to get a job. And so I would go out and get books and read the books. And I read 600 different books on sales and marketing and psychology. One of those books made more of an impact, and I'm not saying this lightly, than any of the others, and that was Herb Cohen's book, You Can Negotiate Anything. He wrote it in the 80s after he helped Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan in the Iran hostage negotiation. He worked with both presidents when Iranian students invaded the United States Embassy in Tehran and held 60 hostages for over 444 days. He even coined the term win-win negotiation in 1962. So to give you a sense of who this guy is, and I tracked him down, professed my true admiration, because over the years, I've saved hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, I used his negotiation tactics in all the sales I've made in the last, say, 20 years. So I'm really excited to share this conversation. I think you're going to find it very valuable. Let's get started.
I was born in Bensonhurst by the sea, overlooking scenic Gravesend Bay, a place where the grass was brown on both sides of the street.
Now, for people that aren't from the area, where is that?
Now, that is in Brooklyn, New York, all business manufacturer. And my mother was a housewife, a traditional housewife.
And what was your dad manufacturing?
My dad made bias binding, which was used inside of men's hats, something that became obsolete with John F. Kennedy, I guess.
Oh, interesting. So you think that the hat era ended with JFK?
Yes, I believe that it did. Suddenly, it was traditional. Men would tip their hats to women. Women walked in the elevator. Man took off his hat. We had all that ritualistic stuff, which your audience probably thinks is, insane. And it probably was.
Now, how did you go from a kid in Brooklyn to negotiating for the presidency of the United States?
Well, I come from a family, by the way, that didn't negotiate anything. As I implied, my parents were happy to be here, and they paid retail for everything. But when I got married, and both my wife and I were going to school, and we suddenly realized we had no income. And so I switched from going to school during the day to going at night and got myself a job as a claims adjuster with Allstate Insurance Company in New York City, where there were 8 million sagas in the Naked City. And suddenly I found that interacting with people was something I could do rather well. And so at the end of a month, everyone would settle 3 cases, and I would settle like 15. And you're talking about corporate people. I said, gee, this guy's doing something. Why don't you tell everybody else what you're doing?
And just for the audience, so everybody understands, what kind of cases were these?
These were bodily injury claims that people made. In other words, they were struck by a car, they went in an automobile, which was rear-ended by our insured's vehicle. Sometimes there were nothing cases, and sometimes they were more substantial. And I had a nice style in approaching people. I treated people with dignity. I assumed people had integrity. And I dealt with people who were on Park Avenue in Manhattan, Fifth Avenue. And at the same time, I dealt with people who were in Bedford-Stuyvesant or rough areas of Brooklyn. And I apparently I did well at this. They had me teaching a course in negotiation in 1963 for attorneys. And this was a two-week course, and then I began to get promoted all over the place, and I had offices that, you know, far exceeded other offices in the company, and then I became an executive and had to move to Chicago, and then I went from Allstate to Sears, which was one of the largest retailers, or the largest retailer in the world at that time. I worked for them, then I worked for IBM. And then I went out in business for myself.
What would you do for Sears or IBM?
Well, with IBM, I was dealing mostly with their problems. They didn't want unions in Sears. And it struck me that the way to avoid that was to manage people better. And this way people wouldn't need unions, and so I try to change the system within Sears and get people to be more concerned about people, treat people fairly, communicate with them, you know, rather than being anti-union. I wasn't anti-union. I was really anti-stupid management, which still prevails, by the way. You know, Sears Roebuck had 70% of the customers were women. We had no women executives. Sears Roebuck's chief buyer at the time of women's lingerie was a man. I mean, these were the stupid, inane things that they did. And for IBM, I was dealing with things like, how do you be more successful as a manager? You know, the emphasis was on technical competency. I was dealing with their top executives. It's really interpersonal competency that is more important. And interpersonal competency is really negotiations. And suddenly, I became someone who knew a lot about negotiations. And then in 1980, I wrote a book called You Can Negotiate Anything. And that book was on the New York Times bestseller list for 37 straight weeks, 44 overall. And then came translated into 36 languages, and suddenly everyone began to call me, hey, he's the world's best negotiator. He's the guy, you know. So,
what are the most common mistakes people make in negotiations that you've seen?
Well, probably the most common mistake is somebody falls in love with a particular deal. In other words, whatever it is, they want this sale more than anything else. They want to please this customer. Or if you're a consumer, you want this particular product. You fall in love with it. Or you buy a home and you go to see the home and your wife says, oh my God, I love this place. If we don't get this home, I'm leaving you. I'm divorcing you. And the husband loves the wife. The children are in the backyard and they see a pool and they say, oh, Dad, I need... Now, what is the father, in this case, it could be the mother, ability to negotiate in that situation? They are greatly handicapped because they have no other options. Yeah, I mean, this even applies to the President of the United States. Barack Obama made this deal with Iran, which allegedly will prevent them from getting nuclear weapons, which don't believe. But let's, you know, talk about that just for a second. The way Obama defined the situation, he says, we either make a deal with the Iranians or we go to war. Well, that means if you don't want to go to war and the American people don't want another war, certainly in the Middle East, you're going to make the deal. They will dictate the terms to you, which, by the way, they did. And so I'm saying to you, you always have got to go into a situation where you're prepared to walk away. Love is something that you reserve for people. So I don't love this item, this deal. I like it. And so I care about this deal, but not that much. In other words, I say to myself, hey, this is a blip on the radar screen of eternity. This is a walnut in the batter of life. Sure, I want it. That's why I'm here. Of course, I would like to make the deal. However, I want it to be fair. And I try to get the other side to understand that I can walk away.
What are you focusing on? You know, what are you thinking about at that moment?
Well, I'm thinking about other options, and you always have other options. You could always walk away. See, first of all, you can negotiate anything, because anything is the product of a negotiation. In other words, what's not the product of a negotiation? Things that are not negotiable. Ethical, moral, and religious principles. I mean, Christ did not say, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount to his followers, hey, give me your input and we'll see if we can't work out a winning speech here. That's not what happened. The Ten Commandments, despite what Mel Brooks would have you believe, was not a negotiated document. And so those things are not negotiable, but everything else is the price of something. And there's, even if you need this price, you can give other benefits to the other side. In other words, you don't want to get in there and focus on price. What you want to do if you're in sales, marketing, you try to figure out what are the concerns and needs of the other side. What I want to do is help them to meet their needs and concerns with my product or my services. And if that's your approach, you're going to be successful.
What are some other mistakes that people make, common mistakes that you see?
Well, what other mistakes? Well, the way people approach other people. In other words, they approach them in a condescending manner, which you shouldn't do. You want to approach people in a congenial fashion, with what I call a low-key pose of calculated incompetence. And indeed, in negotiation, dumb is better than smart. Inarticulate is better than articulate. You want to train yourself to say, you know, I don't know. I don't understand. Help me. Mr. Jones, I'm selling you this thing, but I don't really know what your needs and concerns are. I really want to do business with you. How can I do things to make you satisfied, to make you, you know, want to be in a relationship with me? In other words, that's the kind of stuff you say.
Why do you say that? Why do you approach it like that?
See, people, particularly in this culture, okay, by the way, I've negotiated in other cultures, and a lot of this is true also, but in the American culture, we don't like slick people. We don't like perfect people. I will tell you something no one else has ever said. Romney, when he ran for president, his biggest problem was he looked too good, okay? The man was tall, very handsome, spoke well. He's got a wonderful, beautiful wife who's handled a physical injury, multiple sclerosis, with a great deal of courage. He has good-looking kids who married well. He's got grandkids. And people don't, in this culture, don't like perfect people. We like people who once in a while mess up, as long as they own up to messing up. And so I would always say, in my usual flip manner, the thing that Romney needs is a zit right on his face, you know, a pimple, so people could see, hey, the guy's really human.
I love that. But why would, in a negotiation, would you, I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting was you would like be a shabby dresser, right? Like you wouldn't have an amazing suit, like, you know, coming in like all guns blazing. What is your thought process there?
Well, see, I want people to identify with me. I want them to see, hey, this guy's a human being and this guy is honest. And by the way, I try to be honest, not because I have more integrity than anyone else, but if you start lying, it's very hard to remember your lies. I'm not that intellectual, you know, so I generally tell people the truth. You know, I try to tell them that in a soft way. You know, it's like when your wife says, how do I look in this dress? And you really think, gee, she looks terrible. You don't say that. You know, you present it in a way which she accepts it. And so, you know, do I exaggerate? Do I use a little hyperbole? Yeah, but generally, I tend to be, you know, a forthcoming person. And, you know, probably the best model for negotiation that's simple, that people could understand, are children, kids, because they probably are one of the most successful negotiators in our culture. Now, what do kids do? And most of the people listening to this have children or no children, you know, nieces, nephews. Number one, children aim high. They know that if you expect more, you get more. And so they make unreasonable requests, you know, for parents. And what they do is they tend to pull up the expectations of parents. So that's what you want to do as a negotiator, a salesperson, is expect more, aim high. The second thing is, if you get a rejection at the outset, remember, no is not a final statement. Kids understand this. Kids understand that when parents say no to them, no is an opening bargaining position. No means no at this particular moment in time. Hey, I'll ask him 15 minutes later, you know, 2 hours later, and even tomorrow.
Or is my 3-year-old 10 seconds later? I mean, I was in negotiation with my 3-year-old yesterday, and I have a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old. And my 3-year-old is amazing because he's just so relentless. And, yeah. You know, he just, you know, he wanted we're at the dollar store. I'd never been to a dollar store. And I was amazed, but he wanted a sword. And his mom said no. I said no. And the kid would not leave the store. He's sitting on the floor crying. And ultimately, he negotiated his way into that sword. He got that sword. And I said no at least 15 times, you know, but he got one yes.
Children are persistent. You know, they wear you down. Like I know with my children, my oldest daughter, we had standards. We didn't have exception. We expected her to live up to that. Second kid, we had expectations, but we had many more exceptions. Third child, we were tired people, you know. And, you know, when he'd come to me with problems, I'd say, hey, why don't you bother your sister? I'll tell you. She'll tell you how it used to be around here. So tenacity is very important. Also, what kids do is they say, hey, who's important to this person? Let me influence that person. And so when a mother and father says no, they move on up. They form alliances with grandparents. And it's easy to form an alliance with a grandparent because the grandparent has a common enemy, you know, with the grandchild, the parent. And so that's why, you know, kids are very successful.
So I want to break down a couple of these elements. The first thing is the elements of a negotiation. This to me was eye-opening, where, you know, there's so many more elements in the sale than just the price. And, yes. You know, can you talk about what people are typically missing, you know, or even the common elements, you know, when they're looking at it too narrowly? You know, how should people expand all the different variables that are potentially under a negotiation?
Yeah, see, what you always want to try to do is broaden the gauge in negotiations. If it's narrow, if it's one thing, if it's price, and all you're focusing on is price, well, there tends to be a winner and a loser, and no one likes to be a loser. So when someone says, hey, this is my position, all right, you don't say, I disagree with it, here's my position. If you're a good negotiator, what you say is, how'd you come up with that? I don't understand that. Can you explain it to me? And what you do is you expand the negotiation So it's not zero sum. See, everybody has more flexibility than they realize. For example, you buy a home and you are focused on price. All right. That's one element. Focusing on price produces zero sum, winners and losers. So what you find out is, where is this person moving to? They're going from a home into an apartment. All right. So they're going to end up with a tractor lawnmower that they're going to have to sell. What about you buying that? Or what about the drapes? Okay, will they leave that? Can you buy that from them? How about some of the furniture? They're going into a smaller place. See, so what I'm saying is, the more information you have, the more you could expand the areas where you talk about. And by the way, the last thing you negotiate is price. You know, a zero-sum item. Talk about other things in every single negotiation.
Why would you use price as the last thing that you negotiate?
Because, see, price is a zero-sum thing. It's the hardest thing to negotiate because it produces a winner and a loser. So what you want to do, see, here's where you start negotiations. You always start in a cooperative fashion, congenial, amicable, with what I call a low-key pose of calculated incompetence. All right? Now, suppose you're dealing with someone who is very competitive, who wants to win at your expense. They see you often as someone who's weak. And so what they do is they invest time in that relationship. They spend more time listening to you, talking to you, convincing you. And once people invest in a relationship, it's hard for them to divest. Rats and human beings have this in common. The more energy expended in pursuit of a typical goal, the more desirable that goal becomes. And so one of my strategies in negotiation is to always make the other side feel superior to me. In many cases, you have to work very hard. But nevertheless, it tends to pay off. And so when you negotiate with people, you always start in a congenial, amicable fashion. Why? Because it's easy to go from nice to tough, where it's hard to go from tough back to nice. See, if I start out saying, look, this is it, take it or leave it, and then the other side's packing up to walk out, I say, gee, I guess I came on a bit strong. Are you kidding?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm seeing in several areas that I've used a lot of those techniques. I mean, the quick, I would slow it down, or even if I'm about to make a decision, I would just get off the phone and not commit to it, just because yes. I knew I needed to clear my head. One of the things that I've done a lot of is the expecting more. What you said was groundbreaking for me. Because, you know, if I wanted a $100,000 salary, I would ask for $100,000 because I didn't want to be too greedy. I didn't want to be, and I really had kind of an ethical I didn't want to ask for too much. And I got less, and I always got less. And I was always upset, why am I not, $100,000 a year guy? I'm 85 and I was at 75, but gosh, and what I realized is that they want to win. So, and this is also part of reading your book and then practicing everything. So I'd ask for 120,000. All of a sudden I got 105,000 and I was jumping up and down. Or, I got 105,000 and a $5,000 sign-on bonus. I mean, I used that as a negotiation, when I was in a lot of debt in my early 20s. Moving to New York City, I developed all these other, essentially made up all these other sales, or sorry, all these other jobs that I had received offers from. you know, but I told the person, like, I really wanted to work for them, you know, and I did.
Absolutely.
Because frankly, it was the only offer I had. But even in that moment, I was negotiating, and I got them to pay for me to move out from California to New York. And, but, you know, I had nothing, you know, I was in the hole at that point, but I still negotiated.
Absolutely.
But I think one of the things that was critical to that was I left the place of, even if I don't get this, you know, I want to work for somebody who, you know, I want to work for that. There's so many other factors that, you know, of why I want to work with you guys. And I, you know, I was able to get what I wanted to get, but even if I didn't get it, I had no other option. So I needed to get the job.
And getting a job, the first thing you want to say to someone is, I really want this job. This is my ideal job. Maybe I shouldn't